The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Edgar Villanueva, author of Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving on AM 970 The Answer WNYM in New York City.
We see disruption around us in one industry after another. Amazon and retail, Uber and transportation, Netflix and entertainment, and Airbnb in lodging. Philanthropy, at least at this point, has been disrupted far less. But that may be beginning to change, as several thought leaders have written books that have gotten people thinking about how we're actually going about doing this work. One of the most provocative and talked about of those has been Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. And it's a pleasure to have with us this evening its author, Edgar Villanueva. Good evening, Edgar, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver. I'm honored to be on.
Let's begin with the first word of the title of your book, Decolonization. And it may be best for you to talk about that by telling us first, what is colonization?
Well, colonization is something that often, especially in the U.S., we romanticize because we are taught as young children that the colonizers were heroes. And actually, a history of this country and the establishment of this country in a way that is not actually real. So in the book, I talk about the realities of colonization, which actually was an atrocity. Colonization is about, a group of folks coming into a place where they conquer, divide, destroy, steal, and not just leave as one would do in conquering, but colonization, folks actually stay in the place and force existing indigenous folks to become like them. So there's this forced assimilation of mindset, of culture, of language, of being that is really devastating towards our efforts around diversity because it's really an effort to push us all to be quite the same.
Yeah. Well, you talk about the history of colonization. Is it still going on?
It absolutely is. We often think of that word as something that started 500 years ago in this country, but the dynamics of colonization, which are about dividing, conquering, exploiting, separating, those dynamics are still taking place today. You know, we've all heard the stories about children in cages, for example, down at the border, families being separated. When you look at the dynamics of colonization, it's very obvious that you can see those dynamics in some of our systems and policies, like our public education system, for example.
How does philanthropy perpetuate these dynamics?
Oh, in so many ways. You know, you see these dynamics of colonization showing up in our culture and institutions, but in a really unique way when it comes to institutions that move and control wealth. Because colonization has inherently been connected to the accumulation of wealth over time, we as institutions that control money and control wealth have to understand our connection to that history. And so when you look at in philanthropy, who gets to manage, allocate, control, and spend money, who's actually receiving that money, the history of how that wealth was accumulated, who was harmed in the process, you see a lot of those dynamics coming to play in our history as a sector, but also in our day-to-day practices.
Edgar, put on your social scientist hat for a minute. Why do you think this issue has risen to the fore, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and all that you're talking about at this particular moment in history?
You know, we are living in a time right now where our country is extremely polarized. Politically, we're so divided. We are seeing acts of hate on a daily basis globally and in this country in a way that I've never experienced in my lifetime. And I think that is so because in this country, we have not come to a place of having a process of truth and reconciliation. And so we know from social media to the street to communities that there is this tension in our country that I think many of us are exhausted from experiencing.
That's for sure.
You know, it's not who we want to be as a community and as a nation. And so I think that this particular conversation that is one around, let's have an honest conversation about our history and what has happened here. Let's find a way to understand how we all are hurting and are harmed by this history and the reality of what's happening, and find a path forward that brings us back together. There's an appetite for that type of conversation.
No question about it. I obviously speak to a lot of people in the world of philanthropy, and that is at the very top of every single one of their lists. Now, whether they're dealing with it effectively or not may be a different question, but as to whether it has really raised as a priority for them, that is certainly the case. You have written about philanthropy and the dynamics we just talked about, but not just from the outside. You've been on the inside, and you've gotten beyond the annual report and some of the grants they've made and touting their good works, and you've lurked around in the shadows of these institutions. What did you find there?
You know, you're right. I am an insider, and this is a field that I love. I want to really emphasize that I'm not out to take down this industry, as
right.
some might suspect. I see this as my family that I love, and there's some dysfunction in our family that needs to be called out and addressed so that we can actually walk the talk, of equity. And so I think that, having that insider perspective, the things that I've experienced over the years, one is often the explicit mission of a foundation that is about improving communities or directing funds and supports to communities of color and to impoverished communities. When you look at the data around where money is actually going from foundations, often the end beneficiaries of those funds do not reflect those stated missions. And so we have sort of some delusion going on around
that. Sounds like cognitive
that.
Dissonance.
Absolutely. So those dynamics are very true. We have a lot of power in this field because of our access and proximity to resources. And sometimes the way we wield that power and how we show up as partners and community can be actually abusive or harmful to society.
Yeah. And you make the point in the book that much of the wealth of many foundations was accumulated from what you described before on the backs of other people.
It's very true. You know, my first job in the foundation world was in North Carolina for one of the R.J. Reynolds family foundations. This particular foundation, of course, that family made their money from tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And the foundation that I was working at, called the Kate B. Reynolds Charitable Trust,
sure.
was a health foundation. And so think about that contradiction that, the wealth came from tobacco, smoking, and now we were funding health improvement. And so there's just a lot of contradictions that we hold in this field, which are, the reality of the way things are that we need to grapple with and just put on the table for discussion to understand how have we as individuals and how have we as institutions with explicit missions of doing good potentially have harmed communities in the process?
Well, foundations, about 5% of their money goes to grants. The other 95% is going to be invested to make more money to be able to give more grants, theoretically. And of those 5% going to grants, only 8% is going to communities of color. So what would you do to shake up the world of foundations?
You know, one, I think the stat you just mentioned, Denver, is so compelling. And I've keynoted 30 to 40 philanthropy conferences and shared those numbers.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were actually shocked.
Hmm.
So how is it that we as a sector that are and many of us are so data driven and we love research and reports? This is a missing piece of key data that folks have kind of been agnostic about. So I think one is really looking at that end outcome. If we are really about making change in communities where the hurt is the worst, which is in communities of color, we have to look at our giving and reflect on, are we moving money into those communities? If not, in a way that's equitable, we have to back up and ask why not. It could be how we're governed as institutions and who sits on our boards mm-hmm. and the relationships they have. it may be things in our process that are barriers for, you know, groups working in communities of color, barriers for them having access to the funds.
Yeah. And you look at money in this case, dealing with the trauma and the healing that has to take place as a kind of medicine, right?
I do. I think, you know, money in itself is something that I make the case is neutral.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, proxy for lots of things, including relationships and sweat equity that we put into our jobs. And, you know, I don't think that money itself is something that is a bad thing. We often misquote. I came from a very religious family growing up in the South. And so a lot of quoting of the scriptures and some misquoting of the scriptures.
Oh, that too.
And so, you know, I grew up kind of hearing that money was the root of all evil. And I've come to understand that it's not money itself. It's the love of money that can be evil. And so if we esteem, you know, money more than relationships and people and the earth, then there can be a lot of harm that can happen with that, you know, misappropriation of our priorities. And so it really is thinking about if money itself is neutral, but it's how we as humans have used it. And historically, we've used it in ways that have been terrible and harmful and have left trauma in communities. Can we flip that and actually use resources in a way that helps repair that?
Mm-hmm. The new CEO of the MacArthur Foundation, and that is certainly one of the most significant foundations in this country, he was recently named, and it is a white male.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a lot of opinion pieces. Some of them said that this appointment set back the fight on racial equality. Others said, hey, we can't just deal with this on an appointment-by-appointment basis. We have to look at it from a wider point of view. What would your opinion piece have said, Edgar?
You know, I think I think it's a both and. It would have been a fantastic opportunity for the MacArthur Foundation to put in position someone who was a person of color, especially a woman of color.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been a major statement and, you know, something that would have been applauded by the field. However, I think sometimes in philanthropy in particular and the broader nonprofit sector, we get so hung up on diversity, and diversity does matter. Let's be clear about that.
Yeah.
But diversity is only about representation. It's kind of the easy work. We can easily appoint people of color in leadership positions or invite others to the table. But the hard work that has to happen in foundations is a little bit deeper than that. And that's actually about looking at inclusion and equity.
Sure.
We have seen in philanthropy major initiatives to diversify the field. And we've had an uptick over the years in diversity, even in leadership positions in the field. However, in the past 2 years, data from the Council on Foundations showed a decrease in the number of people of color.
Mm.
And this is because we are, you know, putting people of color in these positions, but not doing the work of asking ourselves, what do we need to change in the culture of these foundations that are actually going to create the conditions for people of color to come in and thrive and succeed in their leadership?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of those folks are put into a situation where they need to assimilate.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to hide their real, authentic selves. And I'm sure you've encountered a lot of those types of situations. Give us an example of one, if you would, and tell me what that does to a person when they have to do that day after day after day.
Yeah, it's really exhausting. You know, most people of color know the term code switching. It's something that you from day one, you're kind of taught that the way you behave at home with your family and with your friends. You have to leave that at the door when you get to the workplace or to schools and places that lift up white dominant sort of ways of being. In my career early on, you know, I worked at the foundation, and funny enough, it was actually led by a person of color.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes that doesn't matter if the culture hasn't changed. And there were lots of things said directly or implied about how I dressed, down to the kind of shoes that I wore. The kind of car that I was driving, because I was not coming into an organization as I had assumed to do work in the community and focus there. But I was actually now a part of this legacy and a reflection of the wealth of this family. And I needed to behave and look a certain way.
The part.
Absolutely. So, you know, that's not that I came in like looking all raggedy or whatever.
No,
right.
No, no.
But
yeah.
But it was still kind of like, wow, someone is actually someone, you know, feels a certain way about the kind of car that I drive you know, or that I'm wearing wingtip shoes. And so that type of forced assimilation on people of color and others over time really takes a toll. It's like an extra tax on us. And the sad part is for institutions that really push a mainstream, not just the way we dress, but a mainstream way of thinking or how we define leadership or success in our organizations, we are missing out on an opportunity to really bring the best of folks into a place that would really create that those diverse work environments that we really want.
What does a decolonized workplace environment look like to you?
You know, I think we have to think about where does power sit in organizations? Who is around the table that's calling the shots? Is there a way, you know, to shift decision making in organizations that equally or more equally distributes power among folks, so that within an organization, everyone feels like they have the potential to bring ideas without retaliation, that they there is more of a consensus way of being and making decisions.
Mm-hmm. What advice would you have for a fast growing organization? Because I run into them all the time and DEI is on the top of their list. And they want to do something at the outset before they have to undo something 5 or 10 years from now. What word of wisdom would you pass on to them?
You know, DEI is not a a side hustle for an organization, right? I think that we have to embed values about equity, especially racial equity, into our work, into our mission, our purpose, our way of being as we're building an organizational culture from the get-go. I do find that it seems easier to work with newer organizations mm-hmm. around building that culture than shifting institutions that have been around for a long, long time, because we know culture is really hard to change.
Hard to move. Yeah, and so. I think you put it really well, because, I mean, as you say, it's not a vertical. It's a horizontal.
Right.
So it has to go across every function of the organization. It just can't be over there in the office in the corner.
Absolutely.
It has to be everywhere. One of the things you float in the book is this concept of a reparations tie on the part of foundations. Now, how would that work?
You know, I'm really excited about the conversation about reparations happening in our country right now. And we've seen it become a part of presidential candidate platforms, which
so David Brooks wrote an article about it in the New York Times the other day in favor of it.
Absolutely. So I feel like all of a sudden this has come to the main stage conversation out of nowhere, although I know there are folks who have been working diligently for this behind the scenes. I think that reparations, two thoughts. One is reparations is a response, or, you know, in a way to try to repair something that has been harmed. In my book, in the second half, I outline 7 steps to healing, which are not a, you know, be all in all process. But to get to a place to right or wrong, there's a process that needs to precede that. And that is a process of truth and reconciliation. I think having a victory around reparations in this country will be challenging, because as a country, we have not grappled with our history. We're not sorry as a country. We haven't apologized yet. So to convince Congress to pass legislation for something that has happened without being sorry for what has happened, I think is going to be challenging. Now, I think foundations have a unique role that they can play. We could fund research, and we could fund activities and programs that will help make the case for reparations. Often that's a role that philanthropy has played, is to be sort of a laboratory, right, to prove that something can work and create models that can be adopted by the government. We also, with our platforms and the spaces that we have in communities, can create spaces to have these conversations about our history and begin to grapple with the work that needs to happen before we may get to reparations.
Yeah. And as you say, I think in the second half of your book, you have a lot of positive recommendations in terms of making things better. Who would be some of the philanthropic models that right now you're most inspired by?
You know, I'm really inspired by foundations who are making a commitment around their 95%, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we have for so long been agnostic about what happens with foundation investments, the 95% that is invested in Wall Street. And I worked in the sector for many years before I even knew that part of the organization existed. You know, most of the time you have investment folks where it's outsourced. And as a program officer, you have no idea what your investments look like.
No. Actually, you meet the investment people at the Christmas party.
Absolutely.
That's about it.
Absolutely. And so the fact that we are now really looking at the entire spectrum of what's happening in philanthropy from the investment side to the program side and thinking about using all of the resources in a way that are really mission aligned is where I'm really excited. And so I think, you know, Nathan Cummings, for example, is a foundation that recently came out, you know, with a decision to 100% of their right. corpus will be invested in Mission Align. And so those are that's the work that needs to happen. It's like the next frontier. It seems totally disillusional to not be using all of your money in a way that's Mission Align, especially since we have tax breaks for this money. The funds should not be tied up in Wall Street and private prisons and fossil fuels and these harmful extractive industries. The other thing that I'll lift up, there are funds and you know, a lot of these are intermediary kind of organizations that rely on partnerships with larger foundations. But foundations like the Schott Foundation, where I work, Groundswell Fund, the Potlatch Fund, these are smaller funds that have deep relationships in community and are able to move funding in a way that is a lot more reflective of the values of equity. And so how do we actually get that type of culture into like mainstream, larger, dominant foundations? And especially with the new wave of tech funders is something to explore. But there are great models that we can all learn from that I mentioned.
Yeah, and I think those smaller ones is the place to start because, again, they show proof of concept.
Yes.
And that's how things generally get going. And as you say, much more shared decision making in those organizations.
Absolutely.
And anytime you bring the people who are closest to the problem, they're going to be the ones who are closest to the solution. And that's probably right. The sector has not done a good job of listening and having them actually have a say in what is going to happen. You are a Native American from the Lumbee tribe in North Carolina. You mentioned earlier North Carolina. Pretty big tribe, 60,000 members. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, so we are kind of based out of southeastern North Carolina in Robeson County. We are the largest tribe east of the Mississippi River.
Wow.
We are recognized by the state of North Carolina. We were recognized in the 1950s by the federal government, but without any type of benefit. And so since the 1950s, we've been in a battle with the federal government for full recognition and all the benefits that entail. And so, we are a vibrant community. We are in coastal North Carolina, the very first point of contact with, you know, for colonization in this country. And so I'm always, I say often that the fact that any strand of anything indigenous remains in eastern North Carolina is really a miracle. And so it's a lovely community right on I-95, exactly in the middle of if you're making a trip from New York to D.C., we're right smack in the middle. So if you're ever in that area, check it out.
Oh, I like your Chamber of Commerce pitch right at the other end. And writing this book provided you with an opportunity to reconnect with your community and speak to some of the elders. What did you discover in that process?
You know, I think, you know, even in our communities, people of color, indigenous communities, we sometimes internalize oppression. Mm-hmm. And so we feel even the pressure from our own communities to assimilate because, you know, our parents want us to be successful. And so for many years, you know, my family have moved away from the community to Raleigh, North Carolina. And I was the only Native in public schools and didn't have any Native colleagues or friends until I got to college. And so I felt like I had kind of given up lots of the identity in order to feel like this is who I had to be successful.
Yeah.
My journey back after feeling sort of lost at a certain point in my late 20s and disconnected from purpose in some ways, I began deeply reconnecting with my community back home. And in the process of this book, really provided that opportunity for me to sit and talk with elders and ask them questions like, what is philanthropy?
Yeah.
what does it really mean to be in community and to take care of one another? What are our ways around that? And some of the values that I was reminded of and have really tried to practice. And this is what we mean by decolonizing, just to think a little bit differently. That's all it really means is to shift your thinking. One is that the idea of all my relations, that we are all connected. You know, our thriving is mutual, our suffering is mutual. If we had a fundamental understanding and belief that we are all connected to other people and to this planet, the decisions that we make every day will be a lot different. We also have a value around the seven generations, meaning that everything that we do now is going to impact seven generations to come. Mm. And so these are ways of very sort of selfless ways to exist in the world and to think about how we move through the world and have our being. And so those are some concepts. The final thing I'll just lift up that is a really core indigenous concept for a lot of communities is the idea of reciprocity.
Yeah.
And so we don't believe in charity in a Western worldview way of, you know, I'm up here and I give to you over here. Our giving is really about I'm giving to you because I'm in relationship with you, and I'm giving to you in your time of need because I know in my time of need you're going to do the same. And so there's a comfort and a peace in knowing that you exist among an ecosystem that's going to take care of you should something happen.
Right. There's no power dynamic
there. There's no power dynamic. And, you know, we don't have that in the broader culture of this country. And so that leads to hoarding and ideas of scarcity and separation.
You know, another book that's gotten a lot of attention, like yours, has been Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. What's your take on that?
I think it's a fantastic book. Anand and I had a chance to do a talk together recently, and he's been super supportive of my work, which I appreciate because he is a well-established author. I think the book is very provocative and direct, and has kind of shook a lot of the beliefs that we hold in this country around doing good, has shook us to our core. So I think everyone should read it. I think the books pair very well together because Anand is sort of bringing an outside perspective. I'm bringing an insider's perspective. I think one of the differences between the two, my book very much brings, I think, a lens of race to the conversation.
Yep.
That is not prevalent necessarily, although we know the elites that Anand is talking about are mostly wealthy white men. And then the other thing is I tried in my book to bring more solutions or ideas. I started in an angry place, to be honest, when I was writing this book. And at a certain point, I thought, well, what would I do differently? What's Edgar's idea for changing this sector? And so because I do work in it, I wanted to bring some practical ideas for how we might advance within the current system, although we know the entire system has a lot of is problematic in some ways.
Yeah, I think constructive pivots like that are really beneficial. Right. You know, a little solutions journalism instead of what's wrong. We have a lot of that. Let me close with this, Edgar. You've been all around the country now, and you've been sharing the message of this book. Any pushback that you believe holds merit, and on the other hand, any places where this has been so embraced that you're actually beginning to see people act already on these recommendations, giving you hope that change is not too far away?
You know, it's very interesting. I have not had a lot of pushback.
Mm-hmm.
Because, one, I think the field of philanthropy and in the nonprofit sector, we are often very polite, and we all assume that we're good people doing good work. And so I'm very open to hear from folks who have opposing views. The only type of pushback sort of that I've received has been from some who say that I am just out to completely dismantle philanthropy and I'm not acknowledging the good that philanthropy has done. And that's just not true. There are other books coming out that are really lifting up giving and best practice philanthropy that I think are sort of wanting to position themselves as a counter argument to my book. My book is not about that philanthropy is bad. It is calling out truth and, you know, the reality of what this is and some of the contradictions that exist that we need to accept. And but I absolutely believe that there is a path to doing this work in a way that is more effective and actually better off for communities. The big surprise for me, Denver, has been the amount of folks who have said this book is so much bigger than just about philanthropy. This book is about sort of racial healing.
Mm-hmm.
And for many white folks actually have really, you know, accepted this book and have lifted this book up as a tool to help them in thinking through their privilege. Many folks have said to me, this is the first time I've read something or I've understood the history of the country in this way that has opened me up to a way that I can actually change and respond and do something about it. And I think that's because this book is couched in love. It is all about bringing people in and meeting people where they are and bringing, acknowledging the pain that we all experience, regardless of our backgrounds or race, as a starting point for a conversation and a path to healing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Edgar Villanueva, the author of Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance, I want to thank you so much for being here tonight. As you said, this book will get people thinking differently and looking at things differently, and that is always a precursor to any kind of action. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show, Edgar.
Thank you for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.